Hi, I'm Ryan McGranigan, an aerospace engineer, data scientist, and all-around art, design, engineering, and science enthusiast. And you're listening to Origins, the show where we talk with thought leaders across eclectic areas of society about their origin stories and trajectories. The purpose is to highlight these thought leaders across different landscapes, to learn about the pivotal moments in their lives and to illustrate the ways of living that help you actionably re-examine your own assumptions and patterns, to provide ideas and stories to give you pause, bring you excitement, and be origins of new trajectories. Hello, ladies and gents, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Origins. Before we begin, just a couple of notes. This conversation was recorded in late February, just before the real onset in the United States of the pandemic. And so we do not cover that topic specifically. And for all of those out there who are suffering from COVID-19, our hearts and our love go out to you. We'll get through this together. The other note is that I thought this episode was incredibly important, and I'm very excited to bring it to you. It discusses something that's very near and dear to my heart, and that I hope will be something that is actionable and inspiring to you to get involved and to be thinking about these issues. And really, Christiane helps us look at the criminal justice system and the reform efforts and the reform that's needed to this system. She takes a unique approach to that, bringing her skills with data and statistics to that. And so I hope that this is an episode that sticks with you and inspires you to look deeper into many of the resources that we provide in the show notes. The final note is, if you're enjoying this podcast, if you're getting value from this, please share it with your friends and go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. It helps people discover the show, and every review is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and please enjoy the conversation. Christiane Lum is an inspiration. She's the lead statistician at the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, HRDAG, where she leads the HRDAG project on criminal justice in the United States. At HRDAG, Christiane applies statistical and machine learning to better understand the criminal justice system and to inform its reform, one of the most dire issues confronting our society. Her work is utterly novel and fascinating, and I encourage everyone to spend some time with her paper, The Contagious Nature of Imprisonment, and work to expose biases in machine learning-based predictive policing. Before going to HRDAG, Christiane held roles as data scientist at a small data science startup business called DataPad, statistician at Virginia Tech, among others. She received a PhD from Duke and a Bachelor's of Art from Rice. She is precisely the kind of person that we want providing the hard research to improve our criminal justice system. Christiane is an embodiment of many of the ideas that we often discuss on Origins. Anti-disciplinarity, the fusion of fields, using one's skills and passions to affect change in the world. This is a conversation that I have long been looking forward to. And Christiane, thank you so much for being on. It's a pleasure to have you on.
It's a pleasure to be here. And after that introduction, wow, that was extremely generous. So thank you. That was really nice. Thanks.
Well, no problem. It really is a pleasure to talk with you. I'm really happy to have you on. I always like to kind of start these off on kind of a random footing or a kind of a surprising footing. And I read somewhere that you deal with existential dread by knitting. Is that true?
Well, yes, that was a response to a tweet I saw. So I can't take credit for the sort of cleverness of that. But I think a lot of people are feeling a lot of existential dread these days between, you know, climate change and sort of the state of our country and all those sorts of things. And so I think knitting is kind of a fun way to get your mind off of everything. I mean, you know, like at least this, I'm not great. Like, let me be clear. I'm still sort of a beginner, but there's a lot of sort of just counting stitches or things like that, that sort of, it's enough engagement. It's not completely mindless to where you have to kind of pay attention to something else, but it's also very relaxing and kind of meditative. So after I saw that tweet, I was I've been working on my existential dreader, which is what I think it'll be probably done in a couple months or something. I've been working on it for a while. It's just taking a while.
And depending on how the world goes, I guess.
Yeah.
So sweaters, do you need anything else?
No, it's my first sweater. We'll see if it actually turns out to be a sweater, or maybe it's just going to be like, if I can't figure out how to do the top, maybe it'll just be like a large tube, which will be repurposed into like a dog bed or something. We'll see.
It'll find a use. Well, that's interesting. So you grew up in Auburn, California, and we were talking before this, it's kind of the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And you launched into later on a career in math and statistics. How did your passions take shape? I'm curious about how you would describe the formation of those passions during your childhood.
Yeah, you know, I've always just sort of been into like general nerdery. So I'm not like, I don't think anyone who knew me growing up would be especially surprised that I ended up going into math and statistics. I think that's sort of fitting. It wasn't exactly, I wouldn't say like from a young age, I was like, oh, I have to do math, or I was especially some sort of like prodigy or anything like that. Certainly not. I don't think I was probably even memorable to most of my teachers on that front, but it was always something I really enjoyed. And, you know, I enjoyed most of school subjects, to be honest. I really was just sort of a geek. I think maybe except history, that was one that I was never super into, but these days it's becoming more obvious to me why it's important that we study it. So, I should probably go back and learn a little bit more about that, but I've always just sort of had an interest in things that are sort of analytical or sort of logical and mathematical. And so It just sort of, you know, seemed natural. I think probably the time when I realized that was when I was like, that was sort of the field I was planning to go into was when I was in high school. I was taking some courses at the local community college, Sierra College. Love community colleges, by the way, fantastic. It was a great opportunity as a high school student to get a little bit ahead. And also I think it offers fantastic opportunities for people.
Completely agree. I think community colleges are an undervalued resource.
So I took calculus over the summer, one summer, again, big nerd. I thought it'd be cool to get a little bit ahead. Maybe I could learn a little bit of extra math. Seemed like a good idea. And I had this professor there, Dan Balgai, who... It was sort of the first time where I felt like people he was explaining math in a way that wasn't sort of just algorithmic, like these are the steps to solve the problem. It was more sort of explaining why things worked. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And so from there on out, it was a pretty straight shot.
I'm always fascinated by these moments. I mean, what can you trace it to a specific event or even moment that you realized or something that clicked, and how did you respond to that moment? How did you interact with that feeling? Was it like this excitement at one point?
I mean, I wish I could point to a specific moment. It was more of just this like sort of slow realization over the course of the summer that like I would find myself, there'd be homework. Part of it would be required and part of it would be optional. And I'd finish the required part and I'd still be sitting there at my mom's kitchen table being like, oh, I have to keep going. This is really cool. Wow. I like just want to keep doing this. And so I think it was sort of that, just being like, this is awesome. I love this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wouldn't say it was like one particular moment in that case.
Hmm. And that led to your undergraduate degree at Rice, studied mathematics. Is that correct?
That is right. I ended up being a double major in math and statistics, which is a little bit of a cheat because there's so much cross-listing between the two majors that I did actually end up finishing both majors, but like I don't even know the percent. There was a large percent of overlap, so it wasn't like two completely separate majors, if that makes sense. In that case, I think the link between the two was I took this class by Richard Stong on combinatorics, which is essentially the math of counting things, sort of like combinations, permutations, things like that, which isn't necessarily a pathway to statistics, but you can kind of see the steps, like easier to count probabilities if you know how many times things happen, others know how many times they could happen. I sort of started thinking about those things, took some statistics courses, and then once again was like, yeah, this is what I like, and sort of continued on that path. So it wasn't much of a I wouldn't really call it a pivot, more just sort of like a little bit of a slide.
Yeah. And so you've talked about this high school teacher, and then you talked about this specific class at Rice. Mm-hmm. Were these people you would consider mentors, what kind of effect did they have on your life? I mean, did you have special relationships with those professors?
No, not at all. Actually, no? In fact, the one I mentioned, no. I mean, there are people I've had special relationships with, but I think I was a pretty ordinary student in each of their classes. I would be surprised if either of them remembered me. In fact, The one I mentioned from community college, I actually ran into him at like a winery, I want to say maybe 8 years ago. And I went up to him and was like, oh my gosh, you know, years ago, maybe it was even 10 years ago. You know, I'm just finishing a PhD in statistics. Your class was kind of what all kicked this off. And he frankly seemed confused. He was like, really, my class? Oh, that's something. And so, no, I don't really think so. I would think I was just probably another student in their class, not especially memorable, not especially stand out at that point.
Did you know then that it was this passion of yours, or how did you think of it in the moment? Or is this later you realized that this was going to be something that you created a career around?
I think once I got into statistics, I realized this was something I was going to be creating a career around, but it hadn't become clear to me until probably more recently, like exactly what that was going to look like. You know, I think at first I was just doing statistics because I thought it was really interesting, and I was really drawn to the idea that it was, you know, sort of so applied. I think one saying that I was told, and I wish I could attribute this, but I don't remember who said it, was that it's a great field if you're the sort of person who's just generally interested in things, which I kind of am, because you kind of get to play in everyone else's backyards. Like, you know, say you're interested in biology for a while, well, certainly you can apply it in that situation. Say you're interested in, you know, social science. Okay, statistics is useful there. Psychology, something. You know, like you can really use it as a tool to explore a variety of interests as they sort of evolve over your life, or you become interested in a new topic. And so I think that was obvious to me fairly early on, and knowing that I am sort of the type of person, I don't usually go into things with like much of a plan. I just sort of let whatever seems interesting or important at the time guide me. That seemed like a useful set of skills to have to be able to kind of continue doing that. So yeah, that's kind of how that happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would benefit the world if more people had a statistics, an understanding of statistics when approaching all these different fields. I think a lot of times, a lot of the things that we see are not subject to robust analyses of the data. And so I'm always curious from the statisticians, or, you know, now a common term that sometimes gets wrapped around statisticians is data scientists. Mm-hmm. I'm curious their thinking on what public information needs more of, how statistics could be better integrated there, how we could help the public be more data literate. And is that something you think about and work towards?
You know, it's something I really agree with. I'm not sure I have like some silver bullet for that. You know, I have no solution for that, but I think it's really important that people have better numeracy. It's one of the things that really surprises me. Like, I'll be, you know, on a plane or something and just doing that kind of boring chit chat with someone before the plane takes off. I'll be like, you know, oh, I'm a statistician. And I inevitably hear something like, oh, I hated that class in college, or, you know, something terrible, I really hate it. Or, you know, something like, I can't even add, maybe that's a little extreme, but it's this thing where people are almost willing to brag about the fact that they're entirely enumerate, which I find really strange, honestly. Like, it's almost a point of pride for people. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly where that comes from. I mean, it probably comes from a place of, I don't know, maybe insecurity or something, where they kind of want to play it off or something. But I just can't imagine it going the other direction, where, you know, someone was like, oh, I, you know, I'm a literature professor. I'm like, oh, I can barely read at a third grade level. You know, it's kind of like, I don't understand how we've gotten to this place where that's kind of almost a funny thing, you know.
Yeah, it's almost self-deprecating.
Expected. Yeah, but it's almost expected that people will be like, oh, that's fine that you don't understand numbers at all. But I mean, I'm not blaming anyone in particular. It can be hard. I think sometimes the way math is taught, though I hear there've been a lot of changes recently to how it's taught, and I can't say I know anything about that. But I think, you know, like I sort of was talking about earlier, I liked math when I was younger, when it was taught in this very, like, this is the algorithm for performing a set of calculations to arrive at an answer, which is, like, this number. But I think maybe if it were motivated differently, which I do think people are trying to do now, I think there is sort of a shift. I think maybe more people would enjoy it. So hopefully the next generation will appreciate it more. I also do think high school statistics would be wonderful for sort of getting people to think critically about the numbers they're seeing, just understanding that, you know, just because there's a number attached to something doesn't necessarily mean it's the truth. It's generated from some type of data, which is, you know, collected by some sort of process, which may be leaving things out. It may, you know, it's really subject to a lot of sort of human decisions along the way, and sort of being able to scrutinize those sorts of things. I think sometimes if there's a number attached to something, people will be like, well, you know, how do you argue with that? That's a number. And I mean, turns out you can't argue with numbers pretty well, if you're really willing to engage with where they came from.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of assumptions that go into those numbers that we read. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of, whether conscious or unconscious, biases that change and affect the numbers that are reported to us. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to be aware of those things. It kind of leads to a lot of the work that you've done. But I'm curious about this idea of, you know, trying to get people to think more critically about the numbers and the information that they receive. How do you do that in the context of your projects?
So I think probably one of the best examples is a project that I did on predictive policing. So the idea behind predictive policing is that a statistical or machine learning model is going to be applied to data, usually police data, to make predictions about who's going to commit a crime in the future or where a crime will occur in the future, with the idea that this information will help police, like, make deployment decisions or figure out who to target, right? And the idea, I think, that underlies a lot of these things, or at least is sort of present in some of the marketing, is that because this is coming from machine learning, or it's coming from computers, that it's in some way objective, in some way race neutral, it's going to reduce police bias, things like that. The project that really best sort of illustrates this issue that you're talking about with bias and data, and it kind of being translated out to the numbers that are reported in the real world, I think can best be seen in this project that I did a few years ago on predictive policing. So for the people who haven't heard of this, predictive policing is essentially applying statistical or machine learning models to police data to make predictions about where crime will occur in the future or who will commit crime in the future. And so what you need to know about these sorts of models or these sorts of algorithms is that they learn patterns in the underlying data. And if the data itself encodes some form of discrimination or bias, patterns that the algorithm learns are those same patterns of discrimination and bias. And those patterns are then used to make predictions for the future. So that same type of bias or discrimination is passed on via those predictions. And so what we did was this company who makes predictive policing software and some other researchers who are involved in this published the algorithm that they're using. So we went and we reproduced that algorithm and we applied it to real police data. And in this case, we applied it to data on reports of drug crimes. And by reports, I don't mean things people calling into the police. I mean, a report was written. So police knowledge of drug crimes, essentially where drug crimes were enforced. And this was in Oakland. And in this data, drug crimes had primarily been enforced in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. That's sort of the background context here. This, despite the fact that if you look at this from a sort of public health context, you'll find that that people across races tend to use drugs at similar rates. And so when we apply this algorithm to this data set, where this data set is likely, in my opinion, generated by a process that involves sort of differential or maybe biased enforcement of drug crimes, the model learned that the Black and Hispanic neighborhoods were the neighborhoods where drug crime would occur, even though what it was really learning was that that's where the drug crimes or the drug laws were enforced and passed by police. So it's sort of learning this bias pattern. And then it passes that bias pattern onto the predictions and would say, okay, police need to be deployed to these places to sort of to continue to enforce these sorts of crimes there, right? And so in some way, the algorithm itself ends up perpetuating the bias from the past that it learns from the data. And it can end up being a sort of, accountability sponge or something, kind of launders it, right? Like when it comes out of something that seems really objective or seems really, you know, science-based or something like that, people, I think, have this tendency, this sort of, you know, there's something called automation bias. I think it's similar to that, right? This idea that computers are, you know, neutral and not biased and objective and really smart and know everything. I think it's easy to forget where those patterns came from originally and really be sort of reflective on why the model is saying, keep going back to these neighborhoods over and over and over. And so that was just one example of that sort of concept, how it's played out in my work. I don't know. There are many, but I think that was the most descriptive.
It's a fantastic project, and you've done so many of them. I'm curious how you yourself maintain kind of a healthy skepticism of the information that you see for a project like that. For instance, you know, your whole purpose is to identify how unknown biases in the data are manifesting themselves and to kind of expose that. And so just as you yourself approach data, how do you maintain that healthy skepticism and that uncertainty that is kind of important?
Yeah, you know, so this is, I'm not sure this directly answers your question, but it is something that I do that I think helps me understand the data a lot better. It's something that I think a lot of researchers, once they've sort of, you know, gotten to a point in their career where they're maybe not sort of just starting out, I really actually like to spend a lot of time looking at my data. Like sometimes I'll even do data entry, like things that people often pay other people to do. I actually like to do a big chunk of it myself because I feel like it's really good for developing an intuition about what's in your data, getting to really know it sort of, you know, before you even start to do the sort of data munging, right? Getting in there and formatting everything and removing things that are errors or correcting errors or whatever, right? I feel like if you haven't really gotten into it and looked at it, it's hard to do that, and you can kind of overlook things. I also find that when we're dealing with data that is about people, and you know, it's about really sort of like sensitive things about people. We're talking about criminal justice data. These are like real people that in some cases have been arrested, they've been imprisoned. I think that kind of closeness to the data reminds you what we're talking about here. It kind of reminds you what the stakes are when we're doing this kind of analysis. And that's, you know, that's constant across a lot of the work we do at HRDAG. Not everything we do is this criminal justice based stuff. We also do some things with casualty estimation. So estimating the number of people who've been killed in various, usually internal conflicts around the world. And I think that's another place where, at least in my opinion, it can be important to keep the perspective that we're actually dealing, we're talking about real lives here and we're talking about real people. And there's this sort of intersection. I think that's kind of what you're getting at, right? This sort of, I don't know, kind of keeping the stakes in your mind, not letting it sort of devolve into something where it's just, it's just another data analysis project. Oh, it's just numbers on my screen. We are actually talking about real people.
Yeah, I love that you bring up the idea of humanizing the data that you're looking at, and how important that is, just because I think it, to really make a difference, you have to speak to people's passions and what really kind of illustrates what's going on to people. And I think the only way to really do that is humanizing things. I mean, that's kind of the whole idea behind stories. You know, stories help us humanize things and relate to things. And so do you use stories or other ways of humanizing the data to pass along the importance of the projects that you're doing?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really complicated question for me. And, you know, in general, no, I don't use a lot of stories. And I think because there's sort of two things going on here. I agree with you. I think in order to get people to really understand the human toll of some of the things we're talking about, the sort of personal stories are absolutely important. And when I talk to reporters, that's always what they want, right? Do you know somebody who's impacted by this algorithm? Do you know how this sort of algorithm is being used and somebody who's been subject to it? Those sorts of things. And those are the story, and those personal stories where people can tell about the impacts on their individual lives and their families. You know, I think that's what really motivates people. I think one of the roles of doing this sort of analysis is a sort of to complement that sort of that type of work where it's really revealing the sort of personal impacts. I think, you know, doing this, the type of work that I do and that we do it at HRDAG, you know, it's more about describing how systematic something can be. So it's sort of the opposite side of that coin. Rather than the individual, it's sort of talking about the aggregate impact or the sort of collective toll of all of these things. So on the one hand, you can, it sort of supports that narrative. And I think, you know, the more powerful part is usually the sort of individual stories, like you mentioned. But I also think when you can back up with numbers and, you know, solid statistical analysis that, yes, this is one really important story. This sort of thing shouldn't happen once in some cases, depending on what we're talking about. And then you can add on top of that, and by the way, we've done analysis that shows how widespread this is. I think that adds another important dimension to the story. So it can't just be brushed off as, say, anecdotal or, you know, well, that's just one person, right?
Right. And these passions, kind of your sensibilities in this way, have led you to a really amazing organization like HRDAG. Mm-hmm. I think I read that you originally interacted or began interacting with HRDAG by cold emailing the founder.
That's right, I did.
Can you talk about that moment?
I was like grad school, and a friend of mine who was in law school at the time, I was sort of talking to her about how I was really enjoying grad school. I was really enjoying doing all this statistics-y stuff, right? Methodological statistics, where I didn't really have much of an application. It was more developing methods for the sake of developing methods. And I was saying, you know, I was really feeling like I needed to do something that had more of a direct impact. And she had seen Patrick Ball, that's the person we're talking about here, the person I cold email, give a talk at her law school. And she's like, you know, this guy who's doing this great statistics work about human rights, the casualty estimation, you should get in touch with him. Okay, do you have his email? She's like, no, I can ask my professor. I don't think maybe she followed up. Maybe he didn't have it. I don't know. And so I was just sort of sitting around and I was like, you know, I should really do this. And so I Googled him and I found his email on someone's CV, like I want to say 10 pages into a Google search. I was like, what the heck? I might as well give it a try. And so I just emailed him and was like, hey, I'm doing a PhD. I'm studying like this, that, and the other in Bayesian statistics. I see what you're doing. You know, it's really cool. Do you need any help? And so I ended up going out for the summer and, that was in, I think, 2009, and then ended up going to Columbia to work on my first project with HRDAG that summer, and have sort of stayed in the periphery of HRDAG ever since until I was, you know, full-time employed with them maybe 4 or 5 years ago now. And so it's been sort of a long journey to end up there full-time, but it was probably one of the better decisions I made to just kind of, I wouldn't say on a whim, but just, you know, what do I have to lose? I'm just going to send this email.
Talk about that moment a little more. I mean, so you had the motivation, you had the energy to look 10 pages into a Google search, and you had this passion to reach out to Patrick. What gave you the confidence and the energy to really pursue that?
Gosh, that's a great question. Probably just like, you know, I don't even know, just like my youthful idealism or something. The idea that, okay, I'm doing all this statistics stuff, but I can actually make a difference in some way, right? Like, I'm not even sure it occurred to me that I couldn't. I mean, it certainly occurred to me that they could say no, but it wasn't like, okay, this will be the end. You know, it's like, here's just one step towards trying to figure out how to do something cool. Right. So yeah, I don't know. I think it was mostly just, what do I have to lose? It seems like maybe they'd be interested. You'd be interested. Who knows? Give it a shot, right?
Yeah. I mean, that youthful optimism or idealism, as you described it, I think is so important. I mean, that period of initial learning, we've talked about it before on this show of it being kind of like a period of learning explosion. Mm-hmm. Your learning is so accelerated. It's so exciting. And I'm really interested in how people pull that outside of just kind of being a young person and how they recreate that in their lives. Do you have ways of trying to maintain that perspective or a beginner's mindset?
Yeah, I think it's one of the things you mentioned earlier in our conversation, you know, sort of like not having a whole lot of respect for disciplinary lines, right? I think when you're coming to something new, just sort of coming to it with that beginner's mindset, like, hey, maybe I have something to contribute here, you know? And of course, you know, there is a whole lot of value to like reading the literature. Obviously, it's, you know, it gets people in trouble if they don't go back and see what other people who are smart, who have thought about things for a long time, have to say about things. But I think there's something exciting about the possibility of bringing a fresh perspective to a new area. And I think that's something I try to do, kind of go I wouldn't say charging in, but, you know, not being afraid to sort of blur disciplinary lines, sort of, okay, you know, I think I do have something to offer with my particular skill set in this other area that maybe I don't know everything about, but, you know, having the confidence that I can learn it, I can figure it out. Let's give it a try, right? Let's see what we can do here.
Yeah. It reminds me, there's this quote by Albert Einstein in his essay, The World As We See It, or As I See It. And he says, the most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion that stands at the cradle of true art and true science. And that's something that I kind of keep close by. I think it's kind of a beautiful sentiment. And it speaks a lot to what you're saying. And so at HR DAC, I really do want to, you know, talk about HR DAC a little bit, just because it's such an amazing organization. And one of the causes that's really close to my heart is criminal justice reform. You know, it's a difficult subject. I think it's one of the most pressing for our society, but it's also something that is hard to study without being outraged with how much is going on. So how do you grapple with that outrage and channel it?
You know, knitting, just kidding.
A lot of knitting, sweaters everywhere.
A lot of knitting. No, that's not true. I don't knit that much. How do I grapple with that outrage? You know, it is really hard to sort of work in this area and not sort of like viscerally feel the unfairness and the injustice that happens in our country. I think just feeling like maybe if I keep going, that maybe something will make a little bit of a difference. Maybe, you know, sort of trying to help steer the ship in a better direction, even if it's only a little bit. I think that's the only thing you got, right? I mean, that and taking breaks and, you know, trying to take care of yourself, I guess. But I think anytime you're working in these areas that are hard, where you're sort of grappling with the real stories of people who are, you know, really kind of not being treated fairly, not just individuals, but just whole swaths of the population, it does sort of wear on you. And so, yeah, I mean, and I think everybody who works in this area gets kind of, I don't know if exhausted is the right word, but it does wear you down a little bit, I think. But just sort of hoping that what you do can maybe make things better.
What do you think are the hopeful points? What gives you excitement? What do you think are the movements happening? Maybe it's from a data science perspective or otherwise.
There are a lot of things that I think are happening right now. I think, you know, across the spectrum, there is quite a lot of appetite for criminal justice reform. So I think we find ourselves in a good place for people who really want to make a difference there. I think one of the areas that I've been following pretty closely over the last few years is pretrial reform. So the idea that, you know, we need to really reduce the number of people who are in jail before their trials. In fact, that's a huge number of people are in jail right now. They haven't had trial. They aren't convicted of anything. They're presumptively innocent. And a lot of them are there because they can't pay bail. And that makes a situation where there's sort of a different justice system for people who can afford it and people who can't afford it. So if you can't afford it, you're stuck in jail. That has all sorts of cascading effects. If you're stuck in jail, for example, you're going to be more likely to accept a plea deal than someone who's out and can fight their case. So it has all these ramifications down the line. Of course, once you've accepted plea deals and once you've been found guilty of things, you know, again, cascading effects. But I think there is a lot of acknowledgement now that that's a problem, that there are so many people incarcerated who are presumptively innocent. And so there is quite a bit of movement towards reforming that. There's been, you know, it's all of this is very complicated. The political landscape around all of this is so complicated. And that is something I think I didn't fully appreciate when I first came to this problem. You know, that makes me sound like Donald Trump, which, God forbid, that's probably the worst thing that happened. Nobody knew it was that complicated. But, you know, it's a really complicated area. But, you know, we saw some legislation get passed a year or two ago in California that's going to be, I think, up for referendum soon. On a bill that was essentially getting rid of bail. We've seen similar things in New York. There's all sorts of places like New Jersey experimenting with different policies to find ways so that people aren't ending up incarcerated only because they can't, there's an amount of money that they can't pay. And so I think, you know, there is a lot of progress on that front. I think people really want to make progress. I think the other thing that I'm hopeful about, and this really overlaps with my research, is that there is a lot of skepticism about the use of algorithms in these sort of decision-making processes around who should be incarcerated pretrial. And this is where things get really complicated, I think, because there are a lot of people who think these sorts of algorithms, essentially risk assessment tools, models that after you've been arrested, so pretrial risk assessment tools are used all over the place. That's sort of a general term. But what I'm talking about here is after someone's arrested, in a lot of places across the country, information about them will be added, will be input into some sort of statistical model. And out the other end will come a risk score. So the score, there'll be a risk of being rearrested, a risk of not showing up for their court appearances, things like that. And often those will be translated into a recommendation for the judge, like you should release this person or you should release this person with no conditions, right? So that's sort of what I'm talking about. And I think a lot of people see these as tools of reform because it can help judges understand how low risk the population in general is, and it can maybe help them separate out the people who are more likely to have those bad outcomes from others. But just like we were talking about with the predictive policing issue, you know, a lot of these models are built on data that is generated by the criminal justice system, right? And so when we're talking about the situation where the data itself is encoding all of these biases, these sort of historical unequal enforcement all the way through the whole process, it's really hard, no, impossible for those models to not inherit some of those problems. And so, you know, like I said, it's really complicated on whether these things are going to help. I think it's seeming like they probably won't help in isolation, is certainly not without other sort of like legislative or policy reforms to accompany them. But I think they're, you know, I think this sort of healthy skepticism around when it's appropriate to be using type of predictive model to make really consequential decisions about a human being's like liberty, I think that's also a move in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. And thank you, first of all. I just think it's important, the skills that you have being brought to this cause. In my own experience, I've done some volunteer work with different organizations in the criminal justice reform movement, and there seems to be an ubiquitous need for ability to intelligently interact with data and help prepare those data. And so I encourage people listening, if they have those skills and they are interested in this cause, to reach out to organizations that they're aware of. But I'm curious where you would push people to who may feel incensed at some of the things they're seeing or want to learn more. Where would you tell them to go, and maybe what resources to pay attention to, or even places to get involved with?
The places to get involved, you know, there are like some of my favorite people to work with are public defenders. I'm not sure how much access everybody has to, you know, volunteering. I'm not sure, you know, as somebody who works for an organization where a lot of people want to volunteer, we do sometimes find that volunteers take more energy than like product they produce, or I don't know, I probably said that clumsily, but you know, it costs us more energy to get people like set up than to actually do things ourselves. But you know, talking to people who are really closest to the problem, that's something that I think has driven a lot of my work and is the best way to get involved. Like, I would say don't just like read a few popular news articles or something and jump right in thinking you understand all the nuances and that you're going to, you know, make some app that's going to make it all better, or you're going to do some analysis that's going to fix everything. I think talking to the people who are closest to the problem and really listening, I think that's one of the things that I've learned a lot over the last several years, is just to sort of sit back and listen to like what all of the problems are, and then try to translate that into, you know, something that your skills can actually help. So in some cases, maybe data science skills can't. In other cases, I have been able to find ways in which, you know, the problems I'm hearing about from the people who are closest to the problem do translate into some sort of like actionable project where we can do some sort of research or you know, do something involving data science or something quantitative to help. But yeah, I think that's probably the best place. I don't know. I don't think I love that answer, but
Well, if other ideas come to you, feel free to send them to me, and I can put them in the show notes. One thing that I pay attention to on a regular basis, just as a very small barrier to entry, is there's a podcast called Pod Save the People. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fantastic, and they emerge in a really approachable way. A lot of news that can help push people to know where to look, what to pay attention to, and what's mm-hmm. going on. So I encourage people to check out that podcast, among other things. But we'll put a few links in the show notes as well.
The Appeal is also great for...
The Appeal?
Yeah.
Is that a podcast? I don't know.
I didn't mind it to have a podcast, but it's like a news website thing.
Okay.
Appeal.org.
And they always have
really interesting articles, a lot of them having to do with criminal justice reform.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
I will take a look. So you mentioned a minute ago when we were talking about kind of how much effort it is, how difficult it is to kind of see these injustices, that you need to take personal breaks. I'm wondering what your personal practices are. How do you recover? How do you maintain your energy?
Oh gosh, sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever pulled an all-nighter, honestly. Like, this is something I think I've been really good at for most of my life, is just realizing that, like, if I'm tired, nothing of any quality at all is going to get done.
Right.
So if I'm really tired, I might as well just go to sleep. And my superpower is being able to fall asleep pretty much anywhere.
At any time.
I don't have huge problems with jet lag, honestly. Not usually. I mean, a little bit. Everybody does, but... Yeah, I'm pretty good at sleeping.
when you wake up in the morning, do you have what's your morning routine? I'm always kind of a nerd about people's mornings routines.
Well, I have a daughter now. She is 14 months old, so my day usually begins with someone screaming, which I could honestly I could do without screaming, but she's wonderful, so it's worth it. But that's sort of still. Situation. Hopefully one of these days she'll wake up and just like talk to herself instead of yell. But for now, that's sort of my morning routine involves getting up and being like, oh gosh, okay, what does she need? All right. going doing morning stuff, her getting her ready for the day, getting me ready for the day. If I were more dedicated to this, maybe there would be exercise. Currently there is not. I would like there to be. There should be. I'd feel better if there were, but there is not. What else? Yeah, honestly, taking care of the baby. Yeah. She's a whole lot of work.
What do you personally need to be ready for the day? What is the checklist of things?
I like to read the news a little bit in the morning. Sometimes, especially lately, that can be really exhausting and maybe doesn't help things. But I do think it's important to have some sense of what's going on. I like to have tea. I like to pet my dogs. Two poodles, standard, mini. Sometimes if the weather's nice, throw the ball for the big one. She really likes it. And honestly, like, until childcare starts, I kind of just hang out with my daughter. We practice animal sounds. She's really good at cock-a-doodle-doo.
What's she working on now?
I'm sorry?
Which animal sound is she working on?
Oh, moo is sort of next up, but cock-a-doodle-doo. She kind of skipped some steps there. Sorry, I don't think anyone actually wants to hear about my kid. But that's like what my mornings look like these days. And so it's less about like what I need to get my day started and more, at least these days, about like how to keep her occupied until childcare begins.
Excellent. Well, I just like, I think it's interesting how people relate to random facts and random things that other people do and kind of see themselves in that too. So thanks for sharing.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, that's easy info. Like I said, I sometimes get really nervous about talking to people, especially recorded. But man, this is easy because you're mostly just asking about me and I'm kind of an expert on me. And so, you know, fairly easy. And these are all nice questions.
Well, thanks. It's been fun. And I want to be respectful of your time. Sure. So I think this might be a good point to move into the last part of the show, which is just kind of a series of four, what I call lightning round questions.
Okay, let's do it.
You're ready for the lightning round. Sounds like.
Do I need more explanation or should I?
Nope, that's basically it.
All right. Ready.
So the first question, what is one book that you feel has impacted you unlike anyone else? So what book do you have a special relationship to?
Oh gosh, what book do I have a special relationship to? This is a hard question. I mean, the books that I think of having the biggest impact are ones that have impacted everybody, like Harry Potter. Everybody freaking loves Harry Potter, right? Like,
oh, that's an excellent answer. I mean,
no, but I mean, everybody's impacted by everybody. I mean, they're fantastic. It's sort of,
what's your special relationship with Harry Potter? Have you reread it?
Oh my gosh, like, yes, I've seen all the movies. I've reread them each like at least 3 times. I love Harry Potter. It's just like, okay, there's so much to it, right? It's just removing myself to this world where it was like, there's something more magical underneath the hood, right? There's like behind the scenes, there's all this magic, and that's really cool. I'm still waiting for my letter from Hogwarts. Hasn't arrived yet, but keeping those fingers crossed. Yeah, that's a great question though. But that book has like impacted everybody, right? So it's hard to say that it had a special impact on me. I think like a whole generation of people, and probably continuing generations of people, have had all sorts of like wonderful experiences with that book. That those books, not a single book, obviously.
Right. So the second question in the lightning round, what passion outside of your own field has most importantly helped set your path?
Okay, so you talked about things, I think, that kind of keep your imagination alive, which, okay, I wouldn't say this really sets your path, but I think it's an important part of, you know, being a well-rounded human. One of my other passions is sewing. I really like sewing costumes. So I'm really big into making Renaissance fair costumes. I haven't gone in a couple years, but that was sort of my thing for several years, was sewing and designing Renaissance fair costumes. I'd make them for my friends, made them for my husband, several for me. Some of them I kind of designed from the ground up, really simple ones. Others I use patterns. I love it. It sort of really stokes my imagination.
That's impressive. I'm picturing some of the Renaissance fair costumes that I've seen, and I'm just blown away by those. They're amazing.
I'm amateur hour compared to some of the people there, but there it's a lot of fun.
Very cool. So number three, what is your latest and most consuming passion? So when you think about this, what is making your heart sing right now?
Oh my gosh, obviously my daughter, right? She's 14 right. months old. She's wonderful. She's like fearless and driven. And, you know, we took her to the zoo a couple weeks ago, or no, maybe a couple months ago now. Time is going like crazy. And for the first time ever, she heard a lion roar. And like her first instinct, like no hesitation at all, was to turn around and went like, roar, right back at her. I was like, man, you are so cool. I wish I just had that. Like, just the instinct, you know, just, yeah, I'm taking on the world. She's great. So I think that's the answer right now anyways.
That's such a special thing. Both of my brothers have small children, so it's been fun to see that same relationship. So
yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Very cool. The final question, what is one thing that you truly and fully screwed up?
Truly and fully screwed up. Oh gosh. You know, I'm the sort of person that will like relive those like slightly awkward things I said in my head so many times for like years afterwards, that there's just like a whole reel of things that I totally and fully screwed up, some which I don't even want to say because they're like so bad. Let me see. What have I totally and fully screwed up? What do most people say for this? Is this one you ask everybody?
I do ask everyone this, and it is a tough one to answer because, you know, people kind of oscillate between whether to make it something very serious or something more flippant. Yeah. Some people have said, sadly, that they've screwed up relationships. Other people have said smaller things like school or something they've done in school. But I mean, one interesting way to think about the question that I sometimes think about rephrasing at least is, what's kind of a failure that's set up for later success?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one thing I can think of, and this is, I mean, this seems like really mild in the whole scheme of one's life. I really screwed up partial differential equations. Like, I took that class my last year of college, and man, I bombed it, like, bad.
There's a segment of the math community that is completely resonating with you right now. And then everyone else is just like, excuse me, partial differential equations? Where does that fall in between algebra and geometry?
Yeah, man, I really screwed that one up, like, completely. But, you know, the sort of, if you want to turn that into a positive, which maybe we shouldn't even bother because, I mean, it was bad. So, you know, it did teach me that I had to like study really hard. Before that, I think I'd kind of gone into things assuming that I could kind of pick them up on the fly. You know, it wasn't, things were going to be, I'd figure it out. You know, it wasn't going to be a big deal. That was one I did, in fact, not figure out in time for tests and things. So that's something I really screwed up.
Yeah, it's those confidence shakers that sometimes illuminate to us how we need to change. So I think that those can be.
Yeah, actually, and that was my last semester of college. And I think that set me up well for grad school, having had that one kind of like big flame out to be like, all right, got to take things seriously. Like, can't just assume I'll just sort of, you know, get this by osmosis just by like being in the room. Like, I really do need to study.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing.
Yeah, sure. So,
Christian, just before we jump off, where do you like people to find you online? Do you like people to follow you on Twitter? Do you have a website? Some
place? I think probably the easiest place to find me is on Twitter. I'm KL Divergence, which is another math joke.
Okay, that's great.
KL because of my initials.
Yeah.
Yeah, Divergence because, you know, Kulbeck Leibler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will put a link in the show notes, and I hope people will follow you on Instagram and take a look, especially.
Oh, no, not Instagram.
I'm sorry, on Twitter. And especially look into some of the work and projects you've done and continue to do at HRDAG that are brilliant. So thank you so much for your work, Christian.
Thank you so much for having me. Seriously.
It's been a pleasure.